Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast on Central and Eastern Europe and a sister project to New Eastern Europe, the exclusive bi-monthly magazine dedicated to this region. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the second co-host of the podcast, Maciek Makulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam. Hello, listeners. This podcast develops thanks to the generous support of from our patrons, for which we are truly grateful. If you like what we do and want to become our patron, please visit us at www.patreon.com.
And Talk Eastern Europe is also a member of the Europod network. This is a network of European podcasts dedicated to bringing discussions on political and societal trends in Europe and beyond.
Welcome again to the next episode. Today we have very special guest. Adam, you did an interview with Peter Pomerantsev. I think he's very well known for majority of our listeners, but maybe let's start with short introduction of him for those who didn't have a chance yet to know his books or his commentaries.
Sure. And just kind of a little bit of background on why we had to, what kind of motivated us for this this episode and this interview. First is that Peter, I've met Peter many times. We've run into each other in different conferences and events. So I was very happy to talk with him and see him. Also, the report that kind of inspired us, it was a suggestion that we received on our Facebook group, which was looking at the situation in Ukraine, actually, a report which was titled From Memory Wars to a Common Future, Overcoming Polarization in Ukraine, which was published by ARENA, which is a special kind of research group based at LSE, of which Peter is one of the main directors of this project. And so that was kind of the motivation for having this this discussion. And of course, Peter, as you mentioned, Peter is a well-known author, writer, TV producer, and I think his first book, which really was one of the groundbreaking books in terms of when we talk about topics like disinformation and Russian propaganda and how it works in the world, this is the book that was titled Nothing is True and Everything is Possible.
Exactly. And let me jump in here. I think it was, of course, about disinformation when this term was not that popular yet. But
right.
With this book, the new wave of a discussion about living in post-truth started. I think that was the term used in this book many times, or in the discussion about this book also here in Poland. And that's interesting, because I think we still live in post-truth era. Mm-hmm. And the term is not that popular as it was a couple years ago. It also shows how we are still struggling with choosing the vocabulary to describe our world.
True. And that book was published several years ago, and it's more about how this kind of post-truth reality was created largely in the Russian context. So actually, Peter has a new book out, which came out in English about a year ago, and I think it's just published now in Polish and a couple other new languages it's being published. And this book is called This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality, which also I highly suggest. And it looks at this post-truth world now, how it works in not just in Russia, but everywhere. And it's much more told through stories, looking at different countries like the UK, like the US, but also Brazil, Philippines. Very fascinating. And for those of you who've read Peter, he's an excellent writer, and it's a very easy read and very nice to understand, very easy to understand mm-hmm. his language.
So the book was published last year, if I remember correctly. The reason why we talk about this book right now is also that the book was already published now in Poland, in Polish, or it will be very soon. I'm not sure about that.
I think it just came out.
It just came out. So this is also information for
our Polish audience.
Yeah. And the report you mentioned in the beginning is also very important, I think. I think we can put a link in the notes of this episode. Have a look on this. Maybe it will be interesting for some of you. What I like in Peter's work is that sometimes he starts a discussion or starts thinking about a problem from very simple questions. And of course, his answers are very comprehensive, but at the beginning there is really a simple question that we can ask ourselves every day.
Okay, so Maciek, I think with that maybe we can go in now to the interview with Peter Pomerantsev.
Absolutely.
Great. So joining me is Peter Pomerantsev, a senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs at London School of Economics. He is the director of the IRENA Think Tank Project and an author as well as television producer. He specializes in propaganda and media. His most recent book is titled This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality, which is currently being released in Poland, I understand, and also won the 2020 Gordon Byrne Prize. So congratulations and welcome, Peter, to Talk Eastern Europe.
Adam, thank you so much for having me. I should note that my latest biography has changed. I'm now a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University, the Aura Center there. I am still physically in England because the move was impossible due to COVID, but I am virtually there and teaching there. I am still a visiting fellow at the LSE, so I haven't cut off my contacts with the LSE.
Okay, we'll definitely have to update that then. Great, thanks, Peter. Well, I have a ton of topics that I think I would like to talk about, but of course our time is limited, so I want to maybe start by asking briefly about the IRENA report, which was just published about Ukraine, which was titled From Memory Wars to a Common Future, Overcoming Polarization in Ukraine, which really was, I found, a comprehensive research project, fascinating look at Ukrainian society with data from public opinion polls, focus groups, films were created in this project. And the idea was, I think, to come up with some recommendations, especially for medias, on how to overcome polarization in Ukrainian society. So maybe could you briefly talk a little bit about the experience of the project? What was the thinking going into it? And what was learned as a result that can be applied beyond just the context of Ukraine?
Sure. So might be worth saying what just IRENA does. So we're a very small research initiative, quite experimental, kind of the two types of projects, essentially. One that analyzes what disinformation campaigns are out there from hostile states, extremists, and so on. I think those kind of projects are quite common now. I mean, there's a lot of this kind of analysis of what's going on the internet, tracking the media, you know. Basically, since 16, I think people have become very alert. Yeah. Or since 15, really, people become very alert to what's going on out there. So, you know, those projects are important, but the other types of projects we do, which are kind of, I think, kind of closer to our mission, we work with media to try to understand how kind of media, civil society, other communicators need to transform how they think about producing good content in a time of polarization and disinformation. Mm. We know that the aim of a lot of information war, disinformation campaigns is polarization, to stoke division. We know that polarized identities from many, many sources are the ones most resistant to facts. Yeah. So if you want to deal with disinformation, you've got to start understanding this deep emotional polarization in you know, a lot of societies. This is not just a problem in kind of immature democracies, as they're known. This is a problem in mature democracies, and probably most of all in the US. So we've done projects in Italy, we did this project in Ukraine, we're doing some work in Central Europe, very much hope to do work in America soon. Where really we just work with media to kind of go, to make it very simple. What if a CNN editor got up in the morning and thought, how do I engage bits of the Fox News audience? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not engage them by, engage them in a genuine discussion aimed at fostering the deliberative democracy, which is kind of there in the word IRENA, which is the title of our research initiative. You know, not a lot of media think about that. Most media are much more attuned to firing up their own side, which is fine. That's completely understandable in the economic markets people live in, but also in the political landscapes people live in. But it's not clear whether that's actually having a really good long-term positive effect and whether that really creates the sort of public discourse that would be resistant to various forms of populism and information war. So the project in Ukraine, as you say, we do a lot of polling, we did a lot of focus groups, trying to understand like people who are divided by culture war issues. So in Ukraine, that's around the Second World War, you know, these themes which are deeply propagandized by the Kremlin. So the people who are on different sides of these themes that have been used as wedge issues by Moscow to try and split society, do they have something else in common? Are we missing something here? And, you know, as always, when you do social analysis, you find there's lots of different groups with different things in common. And we kind of focused on a couple of groups which were, you know, divided on along these culture war issues, but actually had very similar values and aspirations, kind of like urban people in the east and west of the country. And we work with journalists to sort of see what are the things that they have in common when we're talking about historical topics. And, you know, it wasn't maybe a little bit obvious, but things they had in common were things kind of in more recent Soviet history and the 1990s. So we focused our research on that. That doesn't mean you couldn't use, you know, the same analysis to tackle the Second World War. That just wasn't something we chose to do. But look, it's a question of process. There's no like magic bullet. It's a question of media getting up in the morning and wanting to do it. The problem is the economic incentives are the other way. The economic incentive, especially for online media, is to get likes and shares. You do that by being as polarizing as possible. So that's kind of what we're trying to introduce, a kind of a thinking where reaching out across the lines with factual content, with complicated content, with nuanced content, not just with like, you know, football, but with actual stuff that's really, you know, society needs to process. How do you do that? What are the what are the agendas that you pick? How do you talk about it? And so on and so forth. So in Ukraine, you know, we found that people have so much in common. I mean, A, the historical experiences of things like Chernobyl and the 1990s, but also like a deeper thing, a very, I think, Ukrainian trait of resilience in the face of trauma, which is, you know, something that people across the country have in common. I think it goes quite deep, actually. So that's kind of what the project was aimed at. But it's really a methodology thing. You know, we'd love to do the same kind of work in America to get liberal media to start to talk to what they consider are non-liberal audiences. And frankly, I'd love to do it in Poland. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in Poland we have, you know, a classic case of propaganda fueled polarization. And how does one overcome, and also whose job is it to overcome it? I mean, whose job is it to get up in the morning and go, okay, I'm going to create an all national public discourse? Does anybody wake up with that thought?
Right. And is there anybody interested in that?
Well, we haven't started yet in Central. We're just finishing some other work in Central Europe. That's I'd love to get into that discussion in the coming months in Poland. Mm. I mean, you're quite right. You have to have people who are interested. I mean, you have to have people who want this. And look, we're just a research initiative. We play around with different approaches, try to prove and experiment with different ideas. But at the end of the day, for it to be a success, you need scale and consistency. Because as I say, there's no magic formula. There's no like magical way of doing a story and suddenly everyone comes together. It's not like that. It's a question of desire, analysis, and kind of putting that analysis into the center of your editorial policy. And, you know, it's still an art. Being an editor is still an art. It's not like, here is the five agendas you say and the five types of storytelling you do. It's not like that.
Right.
It's always going to be situational. But it's about editors making their talented decisions based on that desire, which, again, are the incentives there? Are the political incentives there? It does come down to incentives.
Well, that's fascinating, and I think this topic of polarization really is, I think, what is defining a lot of the situation that we are experiencing all over. And I want to kind of maybe get back a little bit to the root causes of how we got here. And I think back to your previous book, "Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible," which was kind of a deeper exploration of this creation of a post-truth world in Russia, while your most recent book is on how these processes are kind of more omnipresent in the world. So I guess my question for you is, how did we get here? I mean, how do you explain to people that we now live in this era of disinformation, half-truths, alternative facts, conspiracy theories, what have you, and really what are the causes that got us here? Because I understand maybe something like this happening in a microcosm or in an individual state, but really it seems like this is it's much more universal in 2020.
Yeah, look, I mean, like my book, which I hope your listeners will read, is a fun book full of stories. So I don't want to sound too dry, but there are kind of some basic, quite dry, I suppose, ideas at the core of it. I mean, one of the reasons is technological. And the technological ones are are kind of, they're important. I mean, you know, essentially the pillars of what we thought would make up a democratic information space: freedom of expression, pluralism, the metaphor of a marketplace of ideas. These are things that defined a democratic information space as opposed to a non-democratic one. They've all been hacked, kind of started to be exploited to work against their own ideals. So we see freedom of expression used by regimes across the world to flood the zone with so much disinformation, bots, trolls, cyber militias, that they drown out any kind of constructive discourse, and often are used to kind of crush dissent, but without necessarily stepping over the lines of that would be kind of illegal speech, without necessarily death threats. But if you call someone fake news, that's not illegal. But if you create an army of bots saying you're fake news and undermining faith in someone, that's not illegal. And the answer that these regimes and their spokespeople always give is, this is freedom of expression. You guys wanted freedom of expression. Here it is. Our cyber militias and our troll farms, that's just part of freedom of expression. And with that, this idea that pluralism would lead to a better debate, you know, that's tipped over into polarization that's so vicious that people can't really debate anymore. And with that, the marketplace of ideas metaphor seems very, very, very fragile. So I think technology has got a lot to do with that. We haven't quite worked out what do we mean by a full, free and fair democratic debate now? What kind of norms do we need? What kind of regulation do we need? So, and I think about that a little bit in the book, how we could move towards that. So there's that. But a big part of that, I think, is having media whose mission is to do something about it. Knowing that this is the situation, knowing that political forces, both domestic and extreme and hostile states, play on this, what is the responsibility of media? Is it enough to just sort of shout Trump or Putin is bad? Is that really holding them to account if you're doing that in a way that only furthers the polarization that they're looking for?
Right.
I mean, we just have to start asking the questions. What is the effect of the content we create? I mean, people in media effects have been looking at this for decades, but nobody listened to them. They were like, the way we're doing debate shows is really bad for democracy. I mean, that's been sort of proven by people like Catherine Hall Jameson since the 90s. It's making people cynical and apathetic. And she said that in the 90s, and everyone was like, yeah, whatever. And now like, oh, is actually the way we do media part of the problem? So that's that kind of solution. But there is a deeper cultural one, I think. I think there is kind of, you know, let's summarize it in one idea that one Russian spin doctor said to me. And I said, yes, the end of the Cold War was the end of history, but that was not necessarily a good thing. As long as we had history and big ideas, we had politicians who were trying to prove one idea was better than the other, they needed evidence, there was, you know, some kind of competition around a rational version of the future in the Cold War competition of ideologies and ideas. And that meant that there was at least some sort of capability to have some sort of normative framework around things like facts and evidence and all that kind of stuff. So even when the Soviets lied, they'd act offended if you caught them lying. Now Putin just doesn't care. So something's changed with the value of facts in our kind of public, in our, you know, in society. And people seem to positively embrace politicians who are caught out lying, who are bald-faced liars. There's almost a kind of a pleasure in seeing them rebel against glum reality. And I think that is because, to put it very crassly, all the big ideas based on reason and progress that were meant to deliver prosperity and happiness kind of fell apart for many people. Not for me, not for many people who still find life was going swimmingly, but for enough people, the so-called left behind, who suddenly felt it wasn't delivering. And why should they listen to institutions that tell them what to do, and politicians who tell them about, you know, a rational progress, which they don't experience. And you had this rebellion against reason, I suppose, because it wasn't getting people anywhere. We can talk in a lot of detail about why that happened and when that happened and how that happened in different countries. Very interesting looking at the case of Poland and Hungary, I think. There's a bunch of reason things that happened there. But it seems to be happening in a lot of places. And that's a deeper kind of historical and cultural crisis. And I think we have to deal with both of them, both the technological one and the deeper historical cultural one. And in a way that the technological one is easier to fix. Right. It's harder to implement because there's massive financial interests in the way. But it's actually, at least we can kind of imagine what a healthy internet might look like, for example. Fixing, getting societies to believe that they should invest in a rational future has been harder, I wonder if COVID is changing that. COVID is, of course, a very good reminder of why facts are useful. You know, they can help keep you alive. But you know, we can't depend on COVID-like events all the time.
That's true. That's true. And you mentioned technology is a possible easier to fix. I'm curious, what is your opinion about Facebook and Twitter intervening in posts like, for example, President Trump tweeting something that's completely factually incorrect, and they remove it or either flag it? Does this add fuel to the fire of the polarization? Because then Trump and his side can say, look, they are against us. Yeah. Or is this kind of a step, necessary step that we need to take, but it can be harmful in the short run?
Yeah, I mean, far be it for me to have sympathy with these huge, hegemonic, behemothic, very big, whatever word you want to use, companies. But like, it is weird in America. I mean, they're being criticized by the Democrats for not censoring enough and criticized by the Republicans for censoring. They need to develop clear rules, stick to those rules. I think they have to make their algorithms much more transparent so we understand why one piece of news comes top and one bottom. I mean, the charge that the Trump people make that Google pushes conservative news down and liberal up, we don't know. It's a closed box. It's ridiculous. We can't have our, let's use the metaphor for a public sphere. It's not a great metaphor, but let's say public sphere in one of a different term. Kind of our public sphere in a black box in Silicon Valley. That's ridiculous. So there should be some public oversight of algorithms. Just so look, at the end of the day, these are private platforms. They have rights as well. You know, but they have to be clear what the rules are. They've got to be consistent. There's got to be a court of appeal for takedowns. There's going to be algorithmic accountability. The whole thing has become transparent. And then they do have rights, but they have to then be consistent in how they apply them. The problem is, let's say the Hunter Biden story is that it's not clear whether that is a whistleblower, a disinformation campaign, you know, and what do you do in that moment when you don't know which policy to apply?
Right.
I think they have like policies around hacked material, tainted material, whistleblowers material. But what happens when you're still trying to work out which one it is? and people want the instant answer, especially before an election.
Right.
And so they get caught in the headlights. So they do need clarity of policies is important, but then again, content isn't always categorizable quickly enough.
If we look at Europe, do you think that it is a role here for the European Union to regulate or to come up with policies?
Oh, completely. The chances are that, you know, look, I'm not a lawyer, let's be honest. I'm a writer and I think about the content side of things. But we have also, because it's so integral to these issues, we have also been looking very hard at what should the regulation look like to create an online space that's, you know, at least not terrible for democracy. I'm not saying it should be perfect, but just not bad for it. And of course, it has to start with regulation. The question is it going to be good regulation or bad regulation? And I think the EU's Digital Service Act is going to be a big moment in seeing whether we're moving towards good regulation or bad. There's a very, very intense conversation going on among the expert community about this. I think we're coming towards some basic principles. I think it has to be grounded in the democratic empowerment of the citizen online. I think as an online citizen, you should be allowed to understand whether stuff you're seeing online is being provided by, you know, a Russian troll army or Adam Reinhardt, you know. I'm not saying foreign media should be bad. I think that would be a terrible idea. But you should know that it's them. And you should understand why algorithms show you one thing and not another and how your own data is being used. And if we think about that kind of like empowered citizen online, then I think we can start thinking through what would be democratic regulation. I think trying to censor pieces of content is going to be really hard when that content doesn't obviously violate other people's rights. Yeah. But when we get into political speech, it's going to be hard. Are we comfortable with, to what extent are we comfortable with regulating political speech? As content, very hard, though should algorithms be prioritizing verifiable and high quality? I think probably yes. But again, we need a lot of transparency to explain how they're doing that.
Yeah.
So if you type in Syria on YouTube, yeah, I think they have a responsibility to then serve you up a mix of content where the accurate verified stuff is top. That doesn't mean you won't see the crazy stuff and the disinformation, because sadly that also has a role in a democratic, chaotic space. But it shouldn't be like 10 stories from Russia Today on Syria, which is what happens now if you punch in Syria. It should be curated. It shouldn't be so easy to game. They have a responsibility to give people a genuine plural mix of content and not just the product of a disinformation campaign.
Well, let's talk briefly then about the upcoming election in the U.S., because you mentioned you are now with Johns Hopkins. You're doing some research there, I hope, monitoring what's happening. And obviously, we know that in 2016, there was Russian influence. There were various mechanisms used to influence the election process. Do you think we have learned enough and that we have built enough resistance or resilience to avoid that from happening again? Because obviously, there will be probably some sort of attempts in some form or another. Mm-hmm. Or are we doomed, or I should say the U.S., since I'm here in Poland, but is the U.S. doomed to repeat what happened in 2016?
Well, no, look, there's two things in 2016. If we're talking about the Russian stuff, which is the digital operation, the bots, the trolls, the Facebook sites. And then there's the hack and leak operation, mm-hmm. the hacking of the DNC and the Podesta emails and the leaking of that. Those are two different things. So firstly, the digital one. So the platforms now, then they weren't even looking for this. Now they're looking hard, and there's a whole community of people looking for this. So I think it's much harder. The stuff that the Russians are being caught doing now is much more sophisticated, but also kind of quite small scale. You know, they try to now create these various, it's much more, you know, shtuchna. It's much more
artificial.
It's artisan now. They try to create these kind of newspaper sites, which look genuine, and then commission journalists to write stories. I mean, it's much more sneaky. Much more sophisticated, but also I think less immediately kind of mass scalable. And also in 16, they'd been cultivating all these accounts for 2 years. They spent 2 years cultivating Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, which they then burnt in the election. So, you know, I think now there's a lot more awareness from the platform. So it's going to be harder. But we don't really know how influential that campaign was. It's very hard to measure the influence of a social media campaign generally, and especially one like this, that was already playing into previous biases. You know, they weren't agenda setting. However, the hack and leak campaign was much more significant. We know that had a, you know, we can see almost that had an impact on the mainstream media discourse. Kathleen Hall Jameson at Pennsylvania University has shown how it had an impact on the debates. So they'd leak something during the televised debates, you know, hosts from serious mainstream channels would ask questions based on the leaks. So the leaks did impact the discourse and could have then affected someone, could have affected a work. Yeah, so well, we're seeing that kind of play out now, whether it's Russian or Giuliani, we don't know who's behind the Hunter Biden thing. That's playing out right now. And, you know, so far, a lot of media are being careful, certainly much more careful than Podesta leaks, and talking about this as a potential operation, not just a threat. But it's still, I think, the most popular story on Facebook. Do what you want. Even with Facebook, I think trying to like downrank it in the algorithm, it's still working. There's still a hunger. So maybe that will work. Again, we don't know who's behind it. So
right,
Russian could just be, you know, could just be Giuliani.
Well, that also brings up my maybe second to last question. I wanted to ask about also conspiracy theories in general, and how you see them kind of showing up more and more in Western societies. Because I think, you know, we look back to your first book again. You talk a lot about conspiracy theories in Russia and in society kind of being somewhat like open or understanding of conspiracy theories in the way that not looking for facts or anything like that. And now we see in the Western societies a lot more conspiracy theories becoming popular. And I'm thinking about you know, QAnon, for example. But we also have seen a lot of conspiracy theories with the COVID pandemic becoming more mainstream in countries like the US, the UK, and even Germany. So what is your take on conspiracy theories becoming more mainstream in Western countries, and what might this mean for the long term?
Look, we have to, there's been quite a lot of research about what are the conditions under which conspiracy theories sprout and take root. And look, they're not about epistemology, really. They're about identity. They're about creating identity in groups, especially during times of anxiety, during when people feel powerless, and when people actually feel there's no future. There's also been a correlation, people have seen a correlation. So, you know, I do think we have to look at the ground on which this flourishes. You know, people feel for, obviously during COVID, but generally they feel homeless. You know, so many old ways of life, identities, and so on and so forth have been undermined. And so these certainties have been undermined through technological change, economic change. Just everybody feels, I think, anxious. Mm. And conspiracy theories are a way of resolving that for people. So I think we've got to look at the deeper roots. Plus, added to that, the technological thing. I mean, conspiracy theories are almost their kind of the ideal kind of expression of the things I talk about in my book, and that's why I've talked about them again in my new book. They're both. It's the technology which makes it possible. I mean, QAnon is a business as well. It's become a business. A lot of disinformation isn't political. It's a business. People are putting out fake websites to get clicks and sell something. QAnon, there's a whole business with it now, you know, selling Q t-shirts and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. It's an identity. It's a brand. It's business. It's a tribe. It's a way of belonging. So it's all these things. And obviously technology allows that. So it's almost the perfect coming together of things I've been talking about, the kind of social cultural crisis and the technological possibility. With the COVID thing, we'll see how many people actually believe in the COVID conspiracies, the really radical ones. I know they're out in the streets in Berlin. It's very scary. I still suspect yeah. it's less than other things. And in a way, I hope COVID is a return to some sort of evidence-driven discussion. It's almost like the last stand of science and reason in the face of unreality. Not that the medical guys have got it right, but we're still going to trust them to kind of go along an evidence-based path to find solutions, find a vaccine. So I don't know. I the statistics I saw a few months ago showed actually that the believers in the COVID conspiracies were quite small. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. Probably yeah, smaller than something like people who think there's a deep state.
Right. Yeah. I think in Poland, it's something like 75% of the people believe in COVID. So they're, maybe 10% are believe in the conspiracy as well. The remaining are believe it's serious, but not that serious.
Sure. So, but that's probably much smaller. What percentage believe in conspiracy theories about the Smolensk aircraft crash?
I think it's around 30%. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's less because you can pontificate about Smolensk, but when it comes to COVID, it's kind of, those conspiracy theories are dangerous for your life. So snaps you out of it.
True. And it touches more people as the cases go up. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So the last thing I wanted to ask from you, maybe a few reflections. I'm not sure how much you're following the situation in Belarus, but I think this might be a unique time to see how this disinformation works in a different type of setting where you have a country which is fighting against its own regime, and at the same time, it's not anti-Russian, it's not fully pro-European, it's very much an internal type of process, and there are attempts, obviously, to try to get in and to sway the society one way or the other. Are you watching it? Are you watching Belarus? Do you have any reflections on the situation there from your research standpoint?
Oh, I mean, Belarus is somewhere where I've been to, I found fascinating. I was fascinated by the propaganda philosophy almost that Lukashenko had, which was essentially that all change is dangerous. You know, it wasn't even nostalgia. It was like, the world is dangerous. Belarusians get killed. It's really dangerous out there. Stasis. Let's just pause. And it was like a society paused spiritually, even though economically a lot of things were actually happening. And what's been remarkable is seeing a nation being born, a political nation being born, and in front of our eyes. And that's what people who've been there have found so remarkable. Mm. It is so deep. People go, hold on, we actually have rights. For the first time. I mean, some did in 89, but that was quite a small number, I think. And that's remarkable and inspiring. And, you know, for all the bad news of the last few years, we have seen kind of wave after wave of protest across the world. Belarus, just the most recent one. I mean, there was Hong Kong, which maybe is tragic in some ways, but also in Latin America, in Middle East, in Lebanon, a lot of that, in the Czech Republic, actually, a lot of that kind of calmed down, stops because of COVID. But there is out there, despite the kind of much talked about and noted retreat of democracy, there is still like a thirst out there for people for rights and representation. What it doesn't fit anymore is a clear kind of geopolitical pro-Western meta-narrative. So as you say, even Belarus didn't start like that, though, you know, because of Putin's very strange approach to the crisis, it's become that, actually. Well, it's become, you know, Russia has supported Lukashenko. But, you know, in all these places, people are feeling a gap between themselves and Yeah, the sense of not being represented. Weirdly, that might be the same gap that populists exploited. You know, they also exploited that gap between people feeling parties didn't relate to them anymore, newspapers didn't relate to them anymore, the TV didn't relate to them anymore, and populists kind of stole in and kind of worked in that gap. And I wonder whether the protests we're seeing are actually the real counterbalance to populism. Because instead of kind of the pseudo taking back control that populists give, and I know it's a rubbish term, populist, but I'm using it as a shorthand. You kind of know what we mean.
Right.
I know like political scientists freak out over this, like, which kind of populism? But I'm using it as a journalistic shorthand, very lazy. But I wonder, people say, what's the antidote to populism? I wonder what's actually whether these protest movements are, because that is a case of people actually taking back control and trying to. But they're both kind of weirdly reactions to similar senses of not being represented. But one is a democratic response, while the other one is a much more kind of, you know, reminds one a lot about writings about the idea of the mass by, you know, Hannah Arendt or J.C. Mills. So, yeah. So I wonder whether that's the dynamic you should be looking at. So Belarus is the solution to populism. There you go. You asked me.
So there is some room for optimism in 2020.
I think there is. I mean, it's hard, isn't it? But I think there is. Look, my book is about how the old stories and images we told that equal democracy have grown old and have been exploited or blew themselves up. And I talk about imagery a lot as well. Like, you know, the great image of dictators being pulled down, which was maybe the image of 1989, all these Lenin and Stalin statues, Lenin statues being pulled down everywhere. You know, I think that image dies in Iraq when Saddam's statue is pulled down and it feels like 1989, but it just leads to disaster. So or even the imagery of the great wave of democratization has run out, let alone the stories and the geopolitical kind of vision. But people still want democracy. They're still fighting for stuff all the time. But it's as if we've lost the kind of the big stories to tell around it. And that's kind of the challenge I think we face. My dream before COVID struck was to go around all these movements. You know, I was going to choose like Chile, Lebanon, now Belarus, Hong Kong, whatever, different bits of the world, do lots and lots of interviews and focus groups and try to work out what they have in common. Because it's clear it's not just like freedom of speech and voting rights. I mean, it is in some places, but the political dynamic is different in different places. But I'd like to know what they had in common. That was going to be my fun research project, but ain't much travel going on now.
No, not now, but I have a sense that you probably will have a chance to continue this research and in the coming year or two, as things seem to be developing in that direction. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. And this was really a fascinating discussion. And for our Polish listeners, we have the Polish version of the book, This Is Not Propaganda, available in Polish.
All right, then.
Thanks a lot. All right, Peter, thanks.
It was very vivid discussion, and I love listening Peter and watching. I haven't occasion to meet him in person, but even such an interview is always a good experience. Maybe I would like to refer to the last part of your interview with Peter Adam say that it was very interesting to hear about this problem of lack of big narratives or maybe all these narratives people simply lost trust to those narratives or lost reason as Peter put it and I have a thought in mind that maybe a kind of a new narrative can be thinking how to live our lives without big narratives. Yeah, that could be maybe a narrative itself, because it's a very big question,
especially in the year 2020.
Exactly.
I think it's very interesting what Peter had to say about that, and I agree with you, Maciek, because it is really interesting to see that there are these like outbursts of protests. You know, people demanding that their voices be heard, demanding for greater freedoms, demanding for dignity. Of course, Belarus is the prime example, but we see it in other countries. Even now in Poland, we see it with the women's strike in Poland after the Constitutional Tribunal had outlawed abortion, basically, in most cases. And as you said, it's very interesting is that there's no grand narrative as we had in 1989, and how can we make connections of all these different protest movements that are still calling for freedom, equality, and greater human rights? I think this is the challenge of our time, yeah, right now.
So again, this is maybe a time to ask simple questions. Yeah, do we really need such grand narratives? Can we live without grand narratives? So I like that Peter ended the episode saying he remains quite positive about the future. So I think this kind of questions we can ask also gives us some hope that there is a reason to continue public discussions, not only public discussions, but what we have here, I think we can call a public discussion. So Adam, thank you for this interview. It was really interesting to hear. Anything else you would like to add, or we can move forward to our traditional part of the episode?
I think we can move forward now to the traditional part. So maybe we'll start just by saying that we'd love to have your feedback on the discussion. What do you think about what Peter had to say? There were a lot of very important thought-provoking ideas that he gave during the interview, and feel free to join us on Facebook in our Facebook group of Talk Eastern Europe, and let us know what you think about it. I think it would be very interesting to hear your feedback as well.
Absolutely. And this is also a time where we want to say thank you to all our patrons, to all our supporters. Very recently, we had a very nice meeting with our patrons via Zoom, of course.
Yes.
We've met in, I don't know, five people maybe or so. And again, it was a great occasion to get some feedback from patrons, ideas about future episodes. But this time, I think we also talked more simply about different issues around the world. Mm-hmm. That was very, very interesting experience for me. So thank you once again to those who join us, and we invite others to join us in future, because we are planning next such a meeting quite soon.
Yes, exactly. And this is one of the several benefits that you get that you can take advantage of if you're a patron of the podcast. And, you know, you can start with just $2 a month supporting us. It really means a lot to us that we have a solid core of supporters who join us on the podcast with every episode, and also join us with these discussions that we have now on Zoom. It was really, as Maciek said, I just want to also add, it was a very nice discussion and really, really interesting array of topics and opinions and ideas from other participants. So thank you all for joining us. And Maciek, one other benefit, of course, that we have for our patrons is the traditional shout-out on the podcast. And I just want to say thank you and hello to all of the current 26 patrons that we have. I would love to see that number go up to at least 30 before the end of November, maybe. Maybe it'll be possible. But in any case, thank you and hello to Plamen, Sean, Amy, Naomi, Sylvia, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Anastasia, William, Pavel, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Dennis, Wilhelm, David, Elizabeth, Erica, Janos, Jason, Steve, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Great to meet some of you over the last week, and I look forward to meeting more of you.
Yeah, and maybe the last advertisement today. We are working with Adam on a new series of episodes, this time about Belarus. And yeah, it will be ready by the end of November. So yes. Stay tuned for that. It will be something new. This is new for us, but maybe let's not reveal all details right now.
That's right. That's right. So stay tuned. More information coming very shortly. Okay, Maciek, and thank you to you, to all of our listeners, to all of our patrons. Thanks once again for joining us on Talk Eastern Europe, and we will be with you again soon.
Yeah, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.